The Arthropod.
Five, four, three. Welcome back, everybody, to another exciting episode of Arthropod, your entomology-themed podcast. I'm Michael Scavarla, one of your hosts today.
And I am his co-host, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
And Jody is not with us today. She couldn't make it. In episode 108, I spoke with Viktor Baranov about the Russian war in Ukraine through the lens of entomology and his personal career there. We covered the climate and geography of Ukraine and how that impacts the entomofauna of the country, important historic and living Ukrainian entomologists, Ukrainian amber deposits and how they fit into the wider scope of European amber, and how the war with Russia may affect entomology in Ukraine in the future. We recorded that within a few days of the outbreak of the war. And over the last month, the war has progressed and Kyiv and its suburbs were attacked. And while those attacks were happening, I thought a lot about the people that Viktor had spoken to me about, especially and including his advisor, Val Karnaev. So I reached out to Val to see if he had made it to safety. Viktor said that he was trying to make his way out of Ukraine. And I was really happy to hear that he had made it to Berlin. And he was also gracious enough to agree to have an interview about his journey out of Ukraine. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Val himself. Val, could you say hello to the folks?
Hi, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, good evening or good, I don't know, it's maybe good morning in California still. So I'm Valerie or Val Korniev, and I'm from Kyiv. And I was, and I am, head of entomology at the Schmalhausen Institute of Zoology of the National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. So also my department works with the collections, all the collections. It has a special lab of management of collections. Institutes still have mostly entomological collections and malacological collections too. Originally it was just a part or vice versa, the Zoological Museum of the National Natural History Museum was a part of the institute. Then in 1990s, we have divorced from each other, staying in one big building, different wings of the buildings. So they've got all the exposition, and we've got mostly the scientific part. But with that, we have got almost all the entomological collections, which we must care and which we do have in the same building, including very important type material of the species described by Ukrainian specialists in many families, for instance, bugs, bees, flies, and so on. Some lice on the slides, and many, many other things. Well, so that's my work. I'm running the entomology, and also I'm vice president of Ukrainian Entomological Society. I must coordinate it. And as a part of Ukrainian Scientific Committee, I must also coordinate studies in that area and in biology too with other members. So that's my work. That's my original work. So if you need to know more about that part, where I work, what do we study generally, and entomologists we have about 20 to 30 entomologists with degrees, doctoral degrees, at the institute, and two sections, two departments, one working mostly with parasitic hymenopterans, and the others and the biocontrol, and the second with the rest of insects and management of collections.
How big is the entomology collection? How many specimens are in it?
I'd say it's about 5 million, because we generally have 6 million specimens in the collections in general. So most of them are insects.
That is quite a large collection. To put that, I think, into perspective for some of the listeners, the collection here at Penn State in the Frost Museum is somewhere between 1 and 2 million specimens. So it sounds like that is quite a bit larger than even what we've got here, and larger than, honestly, any of the collections I've ever worked in, Purdue, University of Arkansas. I imagine the Smithsonian is probably bigger, but 5 to 6 million specimens is quite large. That's really impressive.
Impressive, but the conditions of the collections are still quite poor. They have been accumulated during the last, 100 years in the museum, but there were no good management during all this time. We had big problems with the storage of material, and it's quite... there is no room for all the stuff, first of all. Many of the specimens are actually not binned in the collection. They are still dry on the cotton layers since the early times. And we need to do something with that, to database them, to digitize them sometimes. That's how it goes.
Do you know, are most of the specimens from Ukraine and surrounding areas, or do you have a world reach of what's in the collection?
Generally, the most interesting part of the collection, of course, was from different regions of the former Soviet Union, like Central Asia, Caucasus, and the Far East, especially of disputed Japanese territories like Sakhalin and Kuril Islands and so on, and the Far East, which is also disputed with China sometimes as the part of China. Later in 1990s, already after perestroika, the people from the institute got some foreign grants, travel grants, or got money for trips and started to collect somewhere else in Africa. I myself collected also in the Middle East, including both Israel and Iran, for instance. Luckily, I had two passports, luckily for me, with different stamps of visas in different passports. Otherwise, it won't be possible to enter Iran after Israel, or to enter Israel after Iran. But it was all in the past. So we exchanged the material with the other museums sometimes. With the Smithsonian, I donated some specimens, or we had open exchange, so some voucher specimens of common species which were in the museums. They also have been incorporated into Ukrainian collection. But there was a problem, as I told you, there was a problem of lack of the room. A lot of lot of material in my case, was being stored at home. We merely could not purchase any cabinets, drawers, unit trades. That was not possible. This year, after the new year, after Christmas, I got very, very nice news that we have been funded to build, to order new cabinets and new drawers and unit trades, and got some money for that. And then was the war. It was just crashed plans. That's how it goes.
The war is going to be a lot of the focus of today, and I do want to get there. But before we get too far along, we ask a lot of our guests, you know, how you became an entomologist, why you're interested in insects. Can you tell us your entomology origin story, how you became an entomologist and got to where you're at? Like, have you always been interested as a kid, or did it come later in grad school?
Yeah, as a kid, of course. Today I have said that the main principle of human being is a principle formulated by Sigmund Freud. It's a principle of pleasure, of course. If you must get pleasure of what you do, or of having salary, or shopping for that salary, or from your work itself, you must be in love with the object which you study. So in my case, I was 11 years old when I have seen for the first time a very nice shining red butterfly of the Lycaenidae family in my garden. And then I decided that I will be collecting that beauties. Got a lot of literature, what was possible in my little town in the north of Ukraine, in the library, and started to do that. I didn't expect that I will be a biologist or entomologist, just like that, and wanted to know the names of the plants, of the insects, and so on. Latin names, or vernacular names, or so on. And especially I was impressed by the Linnaean classification principles for the plants, or for other living creatures. So I was really interested in systematics of everything, the periodical system of chemical elements, periodical system of elementary particles like bosons, baryons, electrons, and so on. I didn't expect to be a biologist, as I said. I never read books about animals like Gerald Darrell or something like that. That was not mine. But one day, when I decided to enter the university, I wanted to be a chemist of lanthanoid elements, and may happen that I would be a person who will discover the lead lamps or get the Nobel Prize for the white lead light, like it was some 10 years ago. But everything has happened different way. I was said that I cannot, due to my health, I cannot be a chemist as prohibited. They will not give me a medical recommendation. So I decided, well, there was an interest to the insects. Maybe I will try myself with that. And as soon as you love something very strongly, you will find your way, because you will spend all your time for this thing. You will do this the best way. And it happened. It was a lucky kind, but luckily I found my very first advisor, Professor Verves, who told me, okay, guy, do not focus your studies only on the Ukrainian fauna or only on European fauna. Try to study all the world. And these keywords were just in my brain for all my life. I started to do that. It was possible because his friends from the Paleontological Institute in Moscow, they had great money, and they had money also for foreign trips to Seychelles or to Vietnam or to China or to, I don't know where else, to Africa sometimes. So they had some cotton layers with dry specimens of flies, of different other insects, which I could just pick and start to study. Actually, my very first fly, new species of flies, were also from there, from that institute, and it was a fossil fly, and its name was Pseudocinia clotho. As you remember, there were three porkers in Latin mythology. Clotho, who made a thread of life, Lachesis, or Lachesis, maybe in English, who moved this line, and Anthropos, who cut the human life thread. In my case, it was a lucky start because I named the fly, which was discovered as a fossil, I named it Clotho. And it was a lucky sign to my life that I made the first step in a correct way. Then there were many others, many other interesting and not studied before, other fruit flies from Mongolia, from Central Asia, from the Soviet Middle Asia, from Afghanistan during the invasion or before the invasion, and other countries, sometimes from China, very early material. And already in 1980s, 1990s, got the possibility to go abroad, because in the Soviet Union, it was not the question of money. It was the question of permit. You had to be loyal to the Communist Party and so on. And I was not, neither my boss. We were not allowed to go abroad, even to India. I won a trip. I won an exchange of scientists. The Indian guy arrived to the Soviet Union, and I stayed because I was a bad guy somewhere in KGB documents. They didn't love me. They probably believed that I can try to escape, to stay in India. I don't know. But in a few years, maybe in 2 or 3 years, the Berlin Wall was destroyed, and the new time has come. And in 1993, I visited for the first time the Smithsonian. Met my good friend Al Norbom there, and many other dipterists.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah, what an amazing piece of your origin story to have to deal with the KGB and that sort of restriction. It's sort of unbelievable for people like Mike and I think, to have to even consider something like that. What I heard in there was sort of that the Dipterist world was kind of wide open. Was that one thing that appealed to you, a freedom to discover things within the Diptera?
Mm-hmm. What is the question?
Is that what drew you to the Dipterans? Is that there was just so much left to do with them, like so many new questions?
Yes, correct. That was an open community. And it was, in the case of the fruit flies, it was a community of people who wanted to cooperate. Cooperation, but not the competition. That was really, really very good for young scientists. You want to do something very difficult, come and start your job and show what you can do. So it was lucky to me. I did that. And most of my colleagues with whom I worked since that time, they are still good friends, and we have done a lot of joint papers have written a lot of joint projects together with specialists from the United States, United Kingdom, and so on from Costa Rica, and also some general projects like the manual of Central American Diptera, some projects on the Costa Rican biodiversity of Diptera, and manual of Afrotropical Diptera, which has a funny abbreviation, MAD, Manual of Afrotropical Diptera, also was involved, and my spouse, we were involved in all these projects.
I've looked at both of those. I didn't realize at the time that you'd worked on either of those manuals. That's really neat. They're really impressive works.
Yeah, it was wonderful to work with all that team, to meet them on the dipterological meetings, because I'm on the perimeter, staying in Ukraine. I'm on the perimeter of science. We do not have access to many facilities like even elementary molecular labs, or a very, very primitive digitizing systems that we have at the institute, and storaging of material, and the new methods and ways we can treat the material. I always am talking with my former student, Viktor Baranov, about all these things. And yes, I understand that it is important to have access to all these things, to understand how it works. I'm trying to listen what he and my son, what they talk to me about the new methods they are using in Germany, in the United States. So I'm still learning.
Do you feel like when working with your other Europeans or Americans, do you feel like Ukraine is pushed to the fringes, ignored or not thought about when it comes to science?
You know, some people are really, I met the people who were very superior, because they were, they were from Europe, from Canada, from, and who are you? Where are you from? Are you from Ukraine? What is that? Is that a country somewhere near Russia? Oh, really? What are you doing there? How can you study? What do you study? That's the third world. Sometimes living in this way, you feel really the second best scientist, but you Now you understand that you really have friends. You understand how much do you know about the world, Fauna, because your professor told you, you guy, you must study the whole world fauna. Then you will be a very nice specialist because you know the collections, you know the literature, and you have an idea what it can be. You have seen the things that nobody else in the world have ever seen. And it happened. Finally, some Ukrainian specialists, some Ukrainian entomologists were specialists number one in the Soviet Union, in Europe, and coordinators of the studies for some people from Turkey or from Morocco and from Iran or from Middle Asia sometimes. Of the Soviet Central Asia, which we call Middle Asia sometimes. Well, it's difficult to understand that you are really, really mean something, that you know something that nobody else knows in the world, that you yourself is not the second best, and that you're important part of the team. It's difficult to understand, finally. Of course, some American guys have better, or British guys have better education. They have access to different technologies, different facilities, better than I can do that. I still am collecting the carton boxes from the beer in the garbage to make boxes for the next season, to collect, to pin the flies in them, because we cannot order even the unit trades from somewhere. And on the, it sounds funny, but nevertheless, when you go somewhere, you know what you want to collect, and finally found out that you're collecting much better, much more effective than the local specialist you're trying to help your colleagues from the Near East, from Northern Africa, from South Africa. And finally you become somebody who knows, who is the only one in the world who know something about very important families of the Dipterae. In my case, my first study of the Purgotid flies have proven that. I started to work with a sister group of the true fruit flies, which are called Purgotid flies, and they are not the fruit flies, actually. They are sort of parasitic fruit flies. They look like fruit flies, they move like fruit flies, but they infest not the fleshy fruits, not the thistle seeds, not the leaves of the plants, but live adult scarab beetles. And do that in the evening, in the dusk. They are grabbing the beetles and insert the very sharp ovipositor like a tacker into their abdomens, infest them, and then the alien starts to live inside the adult beetle. And then I found out that this small group with some 300 specimens, that this is the group which nobody touched for maybe 400 years, and in some cases from the Linnaean time. That means that the people were describing some species, named them, but in fact, they describe sometimes the same very common African species 10 times, because they had no idea what are the characters they must study for that. And it was a whole mess. The same species were described, scattered over different genera, especially the tropical. The group is strictly tropical. And there was a lot of cases when the same species was described under the same name and among that in the collections of different museums, of the United States National Museum, of the Canada Collection, and especially in South Africa, and more than that, in the Australian Museum, there are still dozens and dozens of undescribed species which must be classified, described, illustrated, and so on. So I was, in this case, I became the only specialist in the world for that group. Later, my colleague Ramon Mello from Brazil also started to study Brazilian stuff. So now we are two, but that's not his main focus. And for me, it was the focus group for maybe 15 years I was studying that. And I have accumulated very big material, which I borrowed from the Smithsonian, from the Canada Collection, and as I said, especially from British Museum and from the South African universities, university museums. And they stayed at my house at home. It was also dozens of small and large boxes with the flies, most of them unclassified. I tried to do that and it was slow work, as all the scientific work I needed to see the types, the type collections, to take pictures of them, first to describe the type specimens, and then also to do many dissections of the specimens to see what's going on. Almost no material was available for DNA studies because they all were old. Pergotics are collected usually at light and only by, and usually strictly by the specialists who collect moths at light. In the case of Australian Museum, my predecessor and colleague Paramonov, who escaped from the Soviet Union during the World War II, he just was the founder of the Australian collection, and he asked his friends who were studying moths and collecting over Australia to collect at light also the strange flies which remind some wasps or the fruit flies or both of them. So they collected huge, maybe five times as many as in the all other world. So the Australian collection is the greatest one, the biggest one at the moment. And also due to my predecessor, Paramonov, of whom you have probably heard. And I also started to work with Australian fauna. So the problem before the war was that I have accumulated almost all the interesting material from all over the world, some types, especially from Belgium, from South Africa, and so on. And it was all the flies were in the same basket at my home. So I had to rescue it in the case of the war or something else. And I was expecting this case, and it finally happened. So that's the story.
Talking to Victor a few weeks ago, he mentioned that you had been trying to move some types out of Ukraine ahead of the war and then after the war broke out. And like you just mentioned, you had a bunch of pergoted type specimens and tephridids and other type specimens. So I guess, can you tell the story about what happened with those types, trying to save them right before the war broke out, and then what happened after Russia invaded, how you got them and yourself out of the country?
Well, it happened already, so I was ready. It happened in 2014 when there was the first invasion of Russia. So at that time, it didn't touch Kiev. And I just took all these specimens into big Chinese bags, large bags, and took them into the train. I bought the whole coupe, all the places, filled it with bags, and made it three times or four times sometimes. Brought them to Uzhgorod and left with my friends at my friend's house, because it's next to the Hungarian and Slovakian border, and hardly they will attack that town. So my friends, entomologists from Uzhgorod University at that time, took all this material and much more, all I had at home, unsorted material from some rare places. And later, after half a year, in the autumn of 2014 or in 2015, I brought them back home. And so the history, in 8 years, the history repeated. I remembered always what has happened to the collection of Hamburg University during the American bombing, and what has happened in 1956, the year when I was born, what has happened to the Hungarian Museum when the Soviet tanks destroyed the building of the Hungarian National Museum of Natural History. And a lot of primary types were destroyed. All what people could bring into the basement, to the cellars, into the basement floor, was saved. But many specimens which was not brought down, they were destroyed also in the fire. So in this case, I thought about Ukraine and this possibility. So just 8 days before the war, or maybe not earlier, in 2020, when we got the new president, which looked very weak person, who probably will just give up Ukraine, in my idea. It was necessary to save it. So even in 2020, I brought an important part of the loans of the material on which I borrowed, especially from South Africa. I brought them to Chernivtsi. I brought them first during my trip to Berlin, here to Berlin, and left them here in the big fridge for a while. Then in 2 years after the corona pandemic, the war has started, and 8 days before the war was started, there was an information that the Russians are prepared to attack Ukraine. And my wife and I, we decided that we must evacuate the most important stuff. So we brought it all again, filled the whole train coupe, and brought them to another university in the west of Ukraine. It was Chernovitz in German, or Chernivtsi in Ukrainian, a city next to the Romanian border. Also, that has no critical infrastructure to be bombed or attacked with missiles. So we brought quite a lot of material there, as many as we could put into the train. Then we decided that in 1 week or so, we will bring another portion there. But in a week, we got Corona, because we were infected in the train, and in the week there was a war. War started in eight days afterwards, and we met it in Kyiv already with Corona and other funny things. And afterwards we were going to stay home. But there were still many material, quite a lot of material at home, much more than 8 years ago. And we finally got a call from a friend of our son, who told us, if you want me to bring you with a car to the train station, because there were no public transportation in the city. I don't drive a car at all, even a bike. So we needed something like that. So we packed the biggest backpacks that we had with boxes and flies with types, and also some bags in our hands. And then we were in the train, a local train, which moved us to the west. In 2 hours after we left Kyiv to Chernivtsi, a missile was exploded just near the train station of Kyiv. So we were happy to leave it 2 hours before. The train was full of people who tried to evacuate their kids, their pets, a lot of cats, a lot of small or large dogs, which they did not want to leave at their houses. They left men, some rarely, very rarely, men were traveling with them. I was one of the very few, just because of my age. It was not so strange as if I was escaping from there. So we reached first one city, then we changed the train to a local, very local bus, then changed it again. And in 2 days, we reached Chernivtsi with all that, the rest of the material. And then they come post-COVID syndrome and all the diseases, they just captured us in there. So we were trapped. That was a nice place with the basement floor and the botanical garden of Chernivtsi. So we spent there almost 3 weeks. We were sick, felt absolutely sick, coughing with high temperature and so on. But we were safe. At the same time, Kyiv was several times was bombing, and the missiles destroyed some buildings near our house. But it was much better than in Kharkiv or in with Chernihiv, which was the cities where Viktor Baranov, for instance, worked and lived in the very beginning of his career, and where his parents were. They was just captured by Russians or surrounded by Russians and destroyed very much. And I knew that my former PhD student, Yulia Gugler, who was working with agromycetes, and this is the family of mining flies, for instance. She and her wife and her husband and her son, they brought all the collections in the Museum of Kharkiv University to the cellar, to the basement floor, and brought sleeping bags and stayed there with the collection. She told me, "This is all my life, these collections. I will not leave them. I was working with them all my life." So they stayed there in the basement. Now it's very hard situation around Kharkiv, and they stay there for more than 1 month, maybe already 50 days. Tomorrow is the 50th day from the very beginning of the war with Russia. So that's how we were in Chernivtsi. We had no idea that we will leave Ukraine. We expected to go back home to take another portion of material and to evacuate it again. We left what we left in Kyiv. We left inside the bathroom, behind two walls. And we expected that it will be not, we will be untouched in the case maybe of not strong fire or not strong bombing. So we left it there. And it's still there, and still we expect to find it untouched. We still believe that it's possible. In Kyiv, in the very first day, on 14th of February, just before the war, I also gave a command to my colleagues and friends, and we brought all the type specimens we could reach. We brought them also to the basement floor of the institute, but there was not much room, and not all the collection was possible to be moved downstairs. So we only sorted the drawers with the types, which were the most important part of the collection. And I hope to find them untouched in there after the war.
Do you know if the collection in the institute, is it still there? Did any of the bombs or missiles hit the collection, or is it still okay?
It's still okay. The institute is in one piece. Even the windows are not broken. It is locked because the people are here and there, scattered over Ukraine. Some in Kyiv, some around Kyiv. Some in the villages which they expected to stay in safe, but which were captured by Russians, and exactly in the towns or in the small towns which had massacre like Bucha. But luckily to us, all the people survived. All the staff of the universe of the institute have survived by far. Some younger guys are on the war as officers. That all we know by far. Not much.
It's good that nobody that you know from the institute's been killed so far. Thank goodness for that.
Luckily, yes, some people died of corona. Still, in the very first day of the war, they were probably lucky not to see what's going on.
How many specimens were you able to evacuate? Do you have any idea? Is it hundreds or thousands or dozens?
No, it's actually it's thousands, thousands. All the stuff which I brought to Chernivtsi was about 10 to 12,000 specimens, because the flies are small, and there is at least 500 specimens in each box. But I had, I believe, some 50 boxes or drawers, so it may be even more, up to 15,000, which I brought with me. So when we were in Chernivtsi, there was a question to go back home, and I got an invitation from my colleague Rudolf Meyer from Berlin to come to Berlin with and to stay here for a while. So they gave me a good proposition, and my wife and I, we are specialists in Tefritoid diptery, so we agreed. It was a long trip through half of Europe, starting from Chernivtsi through Romania with a lot of stops. We took with us two big backpacks with only the most important material, especially the loans, the type specimens on the loan, which 200 liters of backpacks and two big bags with us full of material, because nobody wanted to take people with big luggage. People were living in Ukraine with kids and with pets. We also had nothing, just one shirt, one coat, two pairs of socks, like that, and the documents we had with us. We have not taken almost nothing, and the computers. And I took my favorite camera with me. The laptops and the favorite camera, and no books. All the library stayed at home. And the biggest loss, which my wife was very, even cried for that she left home, a big set, I guess, almost 200 sheets with the information, a sort of database, just records of the specimens from all their collections, starting from the United States National Museum in Washington, D.C., and all the European collections she recorded during the visitor trips, the visitor grants to the museums. So she left it all at home. For her, it was a big loss. She was, as I said, she was crying about that. She just forgot it. But it was a replaceable thing. One day, somebody or even we can go to Washington, D.C. and to repeat this work. And if the type specimens are lost, they are lost forever. And this is the sweetest part of this is the carcass, this is the skeleton of biodiversity studies, the type collections. And we have accumulated all that stuff in one basket. It was our personal responsibility to rescue them. So we decided that probably we must leave Ukraine, even if they will consider us the people who were scared of war, because most colleagues left at home, left in Kiev. They were still working in Kiev at the moment, and I cannot even tell them that I have escaped. For me, it's a big shame that I have left my hometown, that I did not stay, that I did not stay there like my former PhD student in Kharkiv. I must stay with the collection, probably. It was expected like that, to do something in Kyiv, but instead of that, I'm here in safe situation. No hunger, no disaster, sleeping well, hearing no sirens, bombing or anything else. For me, it's a shameful situation and very unethical. That's how I feel.
Do you have any idea when you might go back?
Wait a moment. If it's possible, I will change the battery.
Yeah.
This all depends on how long the war will be. I expect it could long, several months. Several means about 1 year, until the very end, or until the some changes. Nobody knows it exactly. Russians say that they have almost won Ukraine. Putin says that the war will be finished for their sake very soon. And indeed, the situation is very hard. Ukraine is short of the missiles, the arms. At the moment, we need that very much to win. And it's not possible, in fact, to win this enemy, because that's not the President Putin who is the enemy. For all the Soviet times, there were brainwash to make Russian people hating Ukrainians. It was like with the Germans and Jews, but they did that with propaganda for a long, long, long time, because they need to keep their big country together, and the only way to have for this, they have found to have an external enemy, the Ukrainians, Hohly, as they call us. And so it's not the President Putin, it's almost all the common Russians who hate us. And in this situation, they will try to destroy us again and again after Putin. That's not because of the policy, politics, but in fact, what we have everywhere is the war of words, battle of words, what we have. Every war is the battle of doctrinas, of the memes, of the programs which are inside the biocomputers of people. And they run the world, and they make people fighting, which is other, because they are biocomputers which have the programs of destruction in their brains. And the worst is that if you have an enemy, you becoming also aggressive in the very end. So you're becoming an enemy, you're becoming hating the other people from the other side, and you will never reach a peace. It can be eternal hate. So in our case, Ukraine and Russia will never be brothers, will never have peaceful situation again. After what have they done? They have done, and after what Ukrainians have seen, the massacres in Ukraine, we will never be brothers again. That's how I feel. So I don't know when we can, when can we finish exactly the war? When can we start our science again? Real studies. We are going on what we have studied. Maybe 2 or 3 years ago, the projects were trying to do something because we have computers, still have computers. Some people have materials at home. They're trying to go on. I'm trying to go on here in Berlin with my studies. But still, I don't know how we will act in 1 month, in 2 months, what will be in Ukraine. So I'm looking forward to do something for Ukraine, to find some funds, to recover my zoological studies at my institute. That's how it works for me.
I think that's a good place to kind of wrap it up. John, do you have any final questions?
No, I really appreciate your time, Val, and your story. I was pretty spellbound just listening to you talk about your experiences. It's very heartbreaking to be on the other end of the line hearing all of that and knowing that you're right. I mean, these sorts of situations, they don't resolve quickly or amicably, that this will be bad blood forever between peoples. So I'm very sorry for everything you've had to endure.
Val, do you have any, before we sign off, do you have anything, any final messages for anybody listening? Any last thoughts you'd like them to hear?
I'm asking for help for Ukrainian entomology. I'm asking to do all possible for us. I have no idea about the funds which can be used to give some help for Ukrainian army or for Ukrainian science, but we can discuss this personally with the person with those who wants to help us. We will badly need your assistance, your help, your donations. That's very important for us. And the help, like here in Berlin, the possibility to work, the possibility to communicate with the world about the situation in Ukraine. It's the craziest wars, one of the most craziest wars in the world, in the 21st century. When I was young, I have heard a prophecy that Armageddon will happen about Ukraine. And in 40 years or more, I found out that this prophecy was probably truth. The idea that we will really the last battle will happen here is what's going on. We shall see. Maybe afterwards we shall have the end of history of Futuyama. No more big wars, nuclear wars. We still do not know if Russians will not use the nuclear bombs or something like that there. But I want to thank all the people who are helping Ukraine, who are donating arms, who are donating money for people who escaped from the big cities like Mariupol, Kharkiv, Kyiv, and Kherson. So thank you so much for your attention, for your help, and we'll be there. I'll be there. I'm waiting for you, maybe for your questions in the future. Maybe we will meet again.
Well, thank you so much, Val, for your time. I really appreciate you saying yes to come on and talk to us today and tell your story. I was really excited when you agreed to it, and I was not disappointed. It's been fascinating and really sad in a lot of ways to hear what you've had to say. So just thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you so much.
John and I were so engrossed talking to Val that we forgot to record the outro to the show. If you'd like to learn more, you can find us on the web at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @arthro_podshow. You can follow Jonathan on Twitter at @bugmanjohn. And you can follow me on Twitter at @mscavarla36.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.